All right. Moving along, we talked last time about getting drugs into the system and then back out of the system with the ILADMI system, or the set of acronyms that made up ILADMI. We talked about different variables that intervene in that. Today we'll be talking about getting neurotransmitters out of neurons, neurotransmitter release, presynaptic events. That's an important set of relationships that play a role in all the sorts of things that we'll talk about through the semester for the different neurotransmitter systems. One thing that, as neuroscience students, most of you should be familiar with is the fact that neurotransmitter release is typically calcium dependent. It depends on influx of calcium into the presynaptic cell. We'll see a few examples over the semester of non-calcium dependent release. Primarily, that has to do with different neurotransmitter transporter systems, which can move things across the membrane, not from membrane vesicles very often, but from pools of neurotransmitters that have not yet been packaged up for this type of release that we'll be talking about today. And again, there shouldn't be anything new or surprising to anyone on this slide, but just by way of review, the different elements that make up a typical synapse, whether we're talking about in the central nervous system, as shown in cartoon view over here on the left, or a peripheral synapse. Most widely characterized one would be between a neuron and a muscle cell, the neuromuscular junction, or NMJ. In the central nervous system, we'll typically have presynaptic cells, axon terminals, that will be opposed to a postsynaptic cell, postsynaptic neuron, and very often we'll have participating as well, and we'll see important functional roles for glial cells in lots of synaptic connections for different neurotransmitter systems as well. Presynaptically, there's a number of different organelles that play an important role. There are various neurofilaments and various other cytoskeletal elements that are involved in transport of macromolecules and of vesicles and of other protein structures, various other things around the cell. We have vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. We have mitochondria involved in oxidative metabolism and in some cases in the biosynthesis of neurotransmitters. We have coated vesicles, special form of the membrane. It's involved in endocytosis, pulling the membrane back in after neurotransmitter release, and we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Occasionally, we will even, in fact, see a fused vesicle. If we turn this on its side, you would see that this looks sort of like the Greek letter omega, an omega shape. That's one of the clues that we had early on, that there actually was a physical fusion between these vesicles and the cell membrane involved in neurotransmitter release. We obviously have the space between the neurons, the synapse itself, and right on the edge of the synapse on the presynaptic membrane, we have a large number of voltage-dependent calcium channels. The VD doesn't stand for venereal disease, it stands for voltage-dependent, CC for calcium channels. VDCCs. We'll see that abbreviation a lot this semester. Voltage-dependent calcium channels play lots of roles in neurons. This is a critically important one for neurotransmitter release. The neurotransmitter, when it's released from the fused vesicles, can diffuse across the synapse and bind to receptors on the postsynaptic cell. Are postsynaptic cells the only places we'll find receptors for neurotransmitters? No, there can be presynaptic receptors as well. And in fact, there can be receptors on glial cells, as well as on muscle cells. Everybody familiar with what type of photography we're looking at in the lower left-hand corner here? What kind of photographs are those? Those are electron micrographs, one of the several specific types of electron micrograph. Anybody know that? Scanning, that's a good guess. It's wrong, but it's a good guess. What's another major type? Transmission EM, transmission electron microscopy. Okay. In transmission EM, you take very thin sections of tissue or whatever other specimen you want to look at and etch out much of the tissue. The electron dense material remains and therefore scatters the electrons that are used to image this area. So they show up as black spaces and the empty spaces as the lighter colored areas in the photograph. So we can, with that, picture things that are down in the nanoscale, very tiny intracellular structures. So here you can see a presynaptic side of a synapse with vesicles. And in fact, one of those vesicles is fused to the presynaptic membrane. You see the omega shape. Postsynaptically, you see a lot of sort of fuzzy looking material, what we call the postsynaptic density. We'll be talking about different proteins that make up that PSD, or postsynaptic density, as we talk about different transmitter systems. Another example of that, again, the presynaptic is shown here. You can tell these are presynaptic because they contain vesicles. Postsynaptic does not. But here you see some little punctate-type structures as well, polyribosomes. Anyone familiar with ribosomes? Polyribosome just literally means mini ribosomes, typically smaller in size. These are often found in synaptic spines. Synaptic spines tend to be the particular specialization involved in excitatory synapses in the nervous system. And polyribosomes are sites then where RNA is located and where protein synthesis can go on directly at the synaptic contact between that excitatory neuron and the postsynaptic neuron. So synaptic input can cause changes in protein expression at the synapse. This is an area of active investigation in several of the laboratories here at UT Dallas. To pay attention to the y-axis on this set of graphs, notice there's two sets of y-axes. On the left, we're looking at membrane potential of a neuron, in this case, of either a pre- or a postsynaptic neuron. Presynaptic one, we'll be looking at the membrane potential as shown in these black lines. And the artist that illustrated this decided not to have a screen that went up 14 more floors. So truncated it at a small amount of depolarization away from the resting potential. On the right-hand axis, we have a different measure. Not changes in voltage, but changes in calcium concentration. The amount of calcium found in that axon terminal. I want you to look at the relationship between some of these measures. Presynaptically, when the axon terminal begins to depolarize because it's been invaded by a sodium action potential. An action potential traveling down from the cell body, comes down the axon, and gets to the end of the axon. And the axon terminal depolarizes. Sodium channels open, the membrane potential moves away from the resting potential in a more positive direction, depolarization. As that sodium action potential occurs, and it doesn't last very long, look at this time scale. Maybe a little over a half of a millisecond, 500 microseconds in duration. There is a slight lag, but then what's shown in red here is a change in calcium concentration in that axon terminal. Calcium begins to flood into the axon terminal through those VDCCs, the voltage-dependent calcium channels. There's a time lag. It takes a while for that depolarization to translate into opening of the calcium channels and to movement of calcium ions down their concentration gradient If I told you that there are more calcium ions outside the neuron than inside, you would predict that when we open those channels, those calcium ions would come rushing into the neuron. And we can actually measure that change. We now have a very nice two-photon confocal microscope over in Inserl so that we can directly take these types of measures here at UT Dallas. And you can see these changes in calcium concentration going on in this discrete region where we have large concentrations of calcium channels in the axon terminal. So one's an electrical measurement, the depolarization. We could also do an electrical measurement caused by the movement of these ions. But the best way to get a real good handle on it that's not contaminated by this other electrical signal is to directly image the calcium concentration change. It always follows that depolarization event. It doesn't precede it. That goes up for a short period of time, and then the calcium concentration goes down to its prior state. It doesn't stay up forever. It's a life cycle, if you will, of those calcium ions in the axon terminal. And then if we're measuring voltage signals postsynaptically, and this was an excitatory synapse, and again a time lag after that change in calcium, we will see a depolarizing event in the postsynaptic cell. Since this is an excitatory synapse, we would call that an EPSP, an excitatory postsynaptic potential, a depolarization of the target cell. So we're looking at data from two different neurons here, one presynaptic, one postsynaptic. And presynaptically, we're looking at two sets of measures, one a voltage measure, one a calcium measure. These are the sorts of things that we can routinely do in our laboratories. Those relationships clear to everyone. Each of these events takes some time. Takes some time to depolarize the cell. Takes some time for that to have an effect on calcium signaling. Takes some time for the neurotransmitter that's released as a consequence of that calcium increase to cause some event on the postsynaptic cell, for the neurotransmitter to get across the synapse, bind to receptors there and open channels there. So each of these has its own specific time course. It's really important to understand when you want to look at the micro scale of what's going on at the neuron. These are a couple of different ways that we would look at the calcium signal change in the axon terminal. This is looking at what we call a pseudocolor enhanced image of a resting axon terminal, relatively low levels of calcium, only a few hot spots where there's very much calcium present. This is looking at what the data really would look like, looking at very few areas of fluorescence showing up in this region. In this case, we're using a calcium fluorophore sensitive to a particular concentration of calcium. The more calcium comes in, the brighter that fluorophore will glow. And we use a charge-coupled camera to capture that information. During the brief period, shortly after the axon terminal is depolarized, this is what the calcium concentration looks like. We could measure a very large change in calcium coming in. And what the actual data might look like is shown in this slide. This is a very finite event. Comes on at a fixed time point after depolarization. It only lasts a few hundred microseconds and then goes back down to its resting state. Okay. That then is coupled in to the neurotransmitter release mechanisms. We're going to concentrate on this diagram here. Your textbook, in fact, goes into a great deal more detail than I think most of you want to be responsible for the first exam. So let's pay attention to at least the first pass approximation of what's going on. And then if you're interested, you're free to read a great deal more. In fact, we could talk about a lot more We could spend the whole semester just talking about neurotransmitter release if you'd like. But then you'd be on your own for everything else on the exam. So I think this rough approximation will be sufficient for most people. In the presynaptic membrane, the axon terminal, we have embedded voltage-dependent calcium channels, those VDCCs. And they're what, when they're open by depolarization, cause an increase in calcium inside the axon terminal. Think of these voltage-dependent calcium channels as essentially a point source of calcium. One small opening through the membrane, the calcium is going to come rushing in through. We can calculate out then a hemispherical radius within which the calcium concentration will be pretty high. Further away from this point source, it will be decreasingly low. The calcium is going to move just by diffusion within this area. It's not going to be a sphere, but a hemisphere bounded by this membrane. And of course, this oversimplifies and makes this a straight line. This is going to be a three-dimensional shape. But within this given area, we'll have a very high calcium concentration. So any proteins within that area that are sensitive to calcium can be affected by that high calcium concentration. And there's two important sets of proteins that are associated with membranes there. One is the set of proteins that are associated with the presynaptic membrane itself. The abbreviation for those we call SNARES. SNARES. If you're interested in what the word snare means, shown right here. But the abbreviation is more than sufficient for our purpose. Okay, we're not going to go into all the detail of both the phosphorylation and dephosphorylation events involved in the fusion. Again, to do that, we need to go into a lot more detail than what our textbook gives us and spend about 2 weeks' time on it. So let's simplify and talk about these membrane-associated SNARES, one set of proteins, that are going to interact during the fusion event with another set of membrane-bound proteins, but these are found in vesicular membrane, in those neurotransmitter vesicles. Your textbook uses a different set of nomenclature, but I would like this set of nomenclature that investigators down at UT Southwestern use a lot, and that's calling this set of membrane-associated proteins VAMPs, vesicle-associated membrane proteins. V for vesicle-associated membrane proteins. And when calcium comes rushing in through these channels, SNARES are anchored immediately adjacent to these calcium channels. So they're going to be very sensitive to changes in calcium. And if these vesicle-associated membrane proteins are also in the right location, then you can get a strong interaction between these sets of proteins. And that strong interaction draws the vesicle down to the membrane surface and allows then this soap bubble-like lipid bilayer structure to fuse with this soap bubble-like membrane bilayer structure. Any of you ever played with soap bubbles and looked at two of them when they hit one another? They'll pop together and form a larger bubble. If the wind's not blowing too hard or you're not running around too fast, then the bubble just explodes. And again, we can actually visualize these events. Again, in transmission EM, this is an excitatory synapse, in this case, a region that I study a lot in the hippocampus, the CA1 region, a fusing vesicle. And if we were at the same time imaging calcium, you'd see a very high concentration of calcium in this vicinity around this fusing vesicle. You'd use the right stain, you could image right next to it the calcium channel that was the source of that calcium concentration. And believe it or not, here you can see some of the neurofilament proteins that were involved in transporting those vesicles down to that vicinity. So they'd be close enough to sense that calcium change. Cartoon view of what goes on. There's vesicular associated membrane proteins interact very strongly with the snares, the membrane associated proteins, and draw these sets of membranes together until they actually go through the fusion event. Very, very brief interaction. Something less than a microsecond in duration, typically. So to get pictures where the vesicle is actually fused, you have to take many, many, many exposures and get really lucky to be at the right time when those fusions are occurring. So you might shoot hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of exposures and get lucky and get one. Probably not a project you want to do for your senior honors thesis, say, here at UT Dallas. It might take you a few extra years to graduate. Right. Who likes to memorize long lists of things? Never get many volunteers here. Let's simplify again. We know literally hundreds now of vesicle-associated membrane proteins. This is a slide from the edition before this of your one of your two textbooks, the Nestler book. The first of them that was identified is one that's called synaptobrevin. Synaptobrevin. Synapto gives you some clue to where it might be found in synapses. And brevin just means short. It's a nice short one. So if you're going to learn the name of any, how about the first one? There's lots of others that have this synap or synapto. I'm not really interested that you learn all of them. You see something that's named synapto or synap, it's a pretty good guess where it occurs in a neuron. Of course, there's others. Some of them are G proteins. We're going to spend next week or two talking about G proteins. So I'll spare you belaboring what G proteins are at this point in time. And then a few that have other names. Some of them somebody had a sense of humor. Scamps. Some of them you have to understand the full abbreviation. But if you know the general category vamps, and you know the first one that was discovered, that's probably more than enough. You'll know more than 95% of the rest of the neuroscience community knows. If you need to know more than that, you need to know a lot more than is on this slide. And there's three or four or five different labs down at Southwestern that you might want to go work in as well. Well, thank you again, Bill Gates. There we go. He likes to hide part of the slide every time. Again, this is a pretty complex looking diagram. Let's go through it step by step. Understand the important events there. And then understand how we might could interfere with it pharmacologically. The first important step shown here is a process called docking. Moving vesicles down in the right vicinity so that they could be sensitive to those changes in calcium concentration. That's accomplished by different transport mechanisms, particularly by neurofilaments interacting with vamps, the proteins on the surface or coming through the actual membrane that makes up these vesicles. So it's a transport process, getting these neurons down to the end of the neurofilaments, which end very close to the synaptic membrane. Second process is called priming. There's a couple sentences of text in Nestler about priming. This is a phosphorylation-dependent event. We're going to be talking lots about the role of phosphorylation in neuronal activity. Priming gets these vesicles ready to undergo the interaction between the vamps and the snares. Priming. And again, so that this very rapid event can occur. And again, if you were going to memorize one of the vamps, there it is. There's a large number of known snare proteins. The membrane, the cell membrane-associated proteins. If you wanted to learn the name of one of them, this might be a good one. One of the first ones discovered, syntaxin. Again, from the beginning of the name, prefix, you would guess that it had something to do with synapses. And syntaxin, in fact, was first discovered when people didn't know what it did. They just knew that it was always found bound to voltage-dependent calcium channels in presynaptic terminals. So when these vamps have been phosphorylated, when these snares are sitting here ready to go, all that's required is opening of these voltage-dependent calcium channels, that strong pulse of calcium coming into this presynaptic terminal, and then we can get the interaction event between the vamps and snares to cause fusion. Fusion is the last of the processes. Now again, this is an older diagram. And if you read it literature that's more than 4 or 5 years old, which some of you may have occasion to do, you'll see speculation about whether there's some extra structures involved. What were termed fusion pores or fusion proteins. The consensus these days is that those were artifacts of the experiments that were done to demonstrate them. But there's not probably some additional set of proteins required that allow neurotransmitters to come from this space and go out to this space, passing through a set of channels. It looks like there's a direct fusion between this set of membranes and this set of membranes. And I say looks like, because this stuff happens so rapidly that we can't directly visualize that. And the space scale, not just the time scale, but the actual size of these events is so small that we can't directly measure what goes on when those two membranes touch. But the best available evidence says it's a direct membrane-membrane interaction. Doesn't require another set of proteins. Because if it did, we'd have to have a mechanism to line those proteins up with one another as well. And there's no evidence for that. And in fact, most of the cells where people thought they saw these proteins, other groups failed to show those proteins existing. You see this a lot in the scientific literature. People think they have a good idea. They find data in support of it, then somebody tries to replicate it and fail to replicate it and fail to replicate it and fail to replicate it. Then the original group goes back to do it and they can't replicate it either. So then you throw out that piece of the theory. So fusion appears to involve a direct membrane-to-membrane fusion, not mediated by an extra set of protein channels. So everybody clear on the differences between docking, which is transporting the vesicles down, priming, which is phosphorylating some of the vamps so they're ready to go, and then the actual fusion event, which is triggered by the calcium influx. Okay? And I've got one more thing on this slide that we should pay attention to. Some toxins. I think most of the audience here is too young to have been out looking at plastic surgeon offices down in Dallas for Botox injections. Botox is the weirdly named pharmaceutical agent. Somehow Botox sounds better than botulism toxin. But that's exactly what it is. Prior to the 1990s, if somebody talked about botulism, they probably spent several days in bed sick at their stomach. They've probably been to a picnic or something, eaten some bad egg salad, or something that had been out without refrigeration for too long a period of time, and bacteria had found it a nice place to propagate, and had released their toxins as waste products into the food. And these people had eaten it, and then the food had come out both ends very rapidly. Botulism poisoning, and the word for food poisoning. Probably most of you have either had an experience with it or known someone that has. That was a pretty big leap to convince people that they wanted to take the toxin that caused those sorts of symptoms and pay large amounts of money to have that injected into their face. Particularly since most of the symptoms of botulism toxin, it was food that they put into their face. So it's been a very clever marketing scheme to convince people that Botox is something you want, botulism is something you don't, when it's exactly the same substance. Another one, like Botox, tetanus toxin. How many of you here have either taken our lab methods class or work in a laboratory here on campus? Now, you've all had a tetanus shot. You've all got antibodies against this toxin. Again, something unpleasant. But theoretically, tetanus toxin can also be injected in people's faces as a beauty treatment. Now the basis for that, well, hold on, I'll skip this slide for a moment. The basis for that is the very nature of these toxins. Botox, tetanus toxin, and one other that you might be familiar with, called latrotoxin, that name's probably not familiar right now. How about if I point to where it comes from? That's where those spider venom. All share very similar modes of action. Botox inserts a portion of its structure through the cell membrane that acts as an endopeptidase. Peptidases are enzymes that chop up proteins. In this particular case, it targets both snare proteins and vesicular-associated membrane proteins. Both of the sets of proteins involved in transmitter release. Chop them up into small fragments, they no longer function. Tetanus toxin targets just one, vesicular-associated membrane proteins. Black widow spider toxin venom, latrotoxin, again targets both sets of proteins. Again, for your clue, I tend to put a lot more on these slides than I expect you to hang on to. Only parts of them are in color here. But we know dozens and dozens and dozens of other toxins put together we would call excitotoxins or exocytoxins. They prevent exocytosis, the release of neurotransmitter. And all of these fall into that general category because they break the molecular machinery involved in neurotransmitter release. They chop up or cleave up those particular sets of proteins. They do it in a concentration-dependent fashion. The more toxin you inject, the more protein they chew up. We can actually see that here. They're most famously used by plastic surgeons to erase wrinkles on people's faces. Those wrinkles are due to the activity of motor nerves that cause these people to have what we call facial expressions. Typical normal activity. Some people don't like to admit the fact that they've been around for years and years and have smiled at other people, or perhaps glared at other people, or looked cross-eyed at them, or whatever facial expression they like to do over and over and over again. Some of those facial expressions we don't even have names for. Okay. So what plastic surgeons do is inject Botox into those particular zones where the nerves terminate on the muscle fibers that are generating those wrinkles from repeated activation. Essentially, they're paralyzing those sets of muscles by preventing neurotransmitter release there. The muscles are perfectly fine. It's the nerves, the motor nerves, that are not permanently damaged, but for a period of time, while those proteins are destroyed, they're not going to release any neurotransmitter. Does this last forever? Good deal for the plastic surgeon. Those motor nerves regenerate those proteins over time. And so over time, the effect fades, and the frown lines or the laugh lines come back. So they've got patients for life now. There's many complications with it besides that, too. They can screw up and inject it in the wrong spot, and you might be unable, say, to produce tears for a while or something else that might be sort of a vital function. If you don't want your eyes to kind of freeze solid in place and dry out. They can inject it accidentally into a blood vessel, and it can be carried wherever that circulatory system carries it. Block transmission wherever that ends up. You know, if it's something vital like your heart, that can have some bad consequences. There's no guarantee where that toxin would end up in that case. Or they can inject too much. Then you begin to get non-specific effects, not just cleaving up these specific proteins, but any other proteins that are available. You could, in effect, kill the neurons you're targeting rather than having a temporary effect. So if we look at a dose-dependent effect, we're looking at, say, a motor implant potential, depolarization caused by one of those motor nerves. Under control conditions, we'd have X amount of neurotransmitter release, and X amount of contraction of the muscle. As we increase the amount of Botox injected, you get less and less motor activity. Where if you put the concentration high enough, you block all the motor function completely for a period of time. Again, it has nothing to do with the calcium. You measure the calcium influx, in this case an electrical measurement of the calcium channel opening, and the inward calcium current generated. We'll be talking a lot about inward calcium currents. We'll talk more about those conventions in another week or so. Calcium influx is unaffected by the Botox treatment. But the neurotransmitter release and the postsynaptic effect is significantly affected. So part of the mechanism is still intact, the calcium channels and the calcium influx. What's not intact is the fusion of those proteins, and then the fusion of the membranes, the release of the neurotransmitter. And as a consequence, postsynaptically, you don't have the events that are triggered by the neurotransmitter. And again, we typically try to avoid botulism when it's in food, but we'll pay huge sums of money, hundreds of dollars for injections for beauty purposes. Great marketing scheme. profits to be made both by the drug companies and by the physicians administering it. Insurance companies are not so happy with it, and they often won't cover it. All right, we were looking at some electron micrographs earlier, and you hazarded a guess about what type of electron micrograph the earlier one was. How about this electron micrograph? What kind is this? Scanning EM. Okay, it says right there, right? In scanning EM, you fix the tissue and then literally sputter coat it with a thin layer of metal ions. These days you can do it with a plasma as well. You get a very precise coating of the metal and then reflect electrons off of that metal coating. Notice there's nothing transparent here. It's different amounts of reflection from different three-dimensional structures. This lets us see three dimensions a lot better at the surface. So this is a special type of technique called freeze fracturing. You take a synaptic membrane, picture it like the two palms of my hand. Obviously, this is not to scale. Okay? Two synaptic membranes opposed to one another might be 50 nanometers in length or 100 nanometers in length. A really huge one. And if you get really lucky, you freeze these two so they're very rigid, and just like any solid, you can then cleave it, fracture it along different fracture lines. So again, if you do this hundreds or thousands of times, you'll get lucky and you didn't fracture it across a plane like this or like this, but right between those two synaptic membranes, the pre and postsynaptic membrane. So that now you can see one surface or the other. So here we're looking at the presynaptic membrane. And this is an unstimulated set of synaptic membranes. And the salient feature you see is a lot of little dimples, little bumps in that membrane. If you do the right staining, you can show that these are the proteins that make up calcium channels. This is the extracellular portion of those calcium channels, sticking out into the synapse. So you've had to do this hundreds of thousands of times to get a control picture. Now you have to do it hundreds of thousands of times more to get it at the exact moment when the vesicle is fusing with that membrane. You froze it at exactly that point in time. Now you will see things that are holes in the membrane. Those are those fused vesicles. You're seeing that fusion from the outside. If you had a really powerful scanning EM, you could see the inside of the vesicle too. Again, I wouldn't suggest this as your senior honors thesis unless you're planning to graduate in 2051. Hopefully none of you are planning that. And in transmission EM, those holes are what we're seeing as these omega bodies. Those fused vesicles. Put the two together, you get a pretty complete picture of what's going on. So different techniques are required very often to add up to the information that we know about things. Okay. Let's back up a slide here. Cycling of the membrane involved. We talked about vesicles. So let's arbitrarily start at the point where we have identifiable vesicles in the presynaptic terminal. You can identify in most neurons empty vesicles that don't contain any neurotransmitter. We can, in fact, identify proteins that are involved in pumping that transmitter into the vesicles. Those are called transporter proteins. We'll be talking lots about transporters throughout the semester. Once it's filled up with transmitter, and it's transported by the neurofilaments, when it gets to the end of the neurofilament, that's when we say it has docked. It's reached the end of the line. It's in the right vicinity. Then we have a phosphorylation event for priming. Get it ready to be released. Then we have the calcium influx. And then this artist didn't really understand the process real thoroughly. It allows the fusion between the vamps and the stairs. The fusion event. It's not the end of the life cycle for the vesicle. It only stays fused for less than a microsecond. Typically, then, some other transport mechanisms are involved. The first one involves coating at the vesicular membrane. Protein called clathrin. Clathrin. And this happens very rapidly. And again, it appears to involve a phosphorylation event. And then clathrin-coated vesicles are taken up by another transport mechanism and pulled back into the neuron. It appears for different classes of neurons, different phenotypes of neurons, the rate at which that occurs is different. So for some neurons, fusion occurs real briefly, and then it's clathrinized and pulled back in very rapidly. In others, it may take minutes for the clathrin coating to occur and for the membrane to be drawn back in. Eventually, though, the membrane is pulled back in as a discrete vesicle. And then again, for different classes of neurons, sometimes that vesicle then fuses with other intracellular organelles, the endoplasmic reticulum, so that you get what is often called an endosome. Or in many cases, the vesicle bypasses that stage and goes back to being filled up again and readied for release again. So it's a life cycle for the membrane making up the vesicle. And new vesicles can be pinched off from the endoplasmic reticulum. So you will have changes in the number of vesicles at different times in different axon terminals as well, particularly if you've been stimulating that terminal a lot. And for a short period of time, you'll deplete all of the available vesicles that are ready to release. The neuron can then step things back up, produce lots of new vesicles, not wait for them to be recycled, but pinch off new ones to make up for that deficit. Or if there's a condition where this synapse isn't being used much, withdraw some of those vesicles. Pull them back into the endoplasmic reticulum. So there's a great deal of plasticity can go on in this recycling event. We have a lot of evidence for this recycling. If you put different types of tags on the cell membrane, that are known to interact with clathrin. Put them out here. When the clathrin coats the vesicles, these tags will actually end up on the inside interacting with the clathrin that's on the outside of the vesicles. And these tags will then be visible inside the neuron at a later point in time. So you can measure the time course of this recycling. And that has shown us that in different types of neurons, different patterns of recycling emerge. Some of them you'll get multiple vesicles fusing before they're pulled back in. And this is early studies showed evidence mostly for this. As we got more sophisticated, And particularly as we begin to look more and more at synapses in the central nervous system, we saw more evidence for this sort of a recycling. Very brief fusion event, and it's pulled back in almost immediately. In fact, in many cases, these are coated with clathrin before they even fuse. And the last, again, a large number of vesicles are fused before they're pulled back up, enough to where you actually get a change in the total membrane area of the neuron, which, again, can be measured capacitively, changing the capacitance of that cell. Mostly shows up in motor neurons. Yes. Classical, it might take some time for anyone or a few. Bulk, it might be large numbers of vesicles before they're pulled back in. And again, quite some time. This one, they used a model. We're not big on mass transit in the Dallas area. But if you ever go to Washington, D.C. or any big cities, you'll see commuter parking lots labeled that way. You know, it's just basically you drop somebody off and you're gone. And that's the model that they use to describe the neurotransmitter vesicles activity. All right, so let's summarize what's going on. We have vesicles, they've got to be filled with transmitter, they've got to be transported down to the membrane, they've got to be docked, they've got to be primed. Of course, at the membrane itself, you've got to have the calcium channels and the snare proteins. When you get the calcium influx coming in, for that brief period of time, the calcium ions are at a high concentration, and you're going to get a fusion between the vamps and the snares. And that's when you get release of neurotransmitter. Very rapid process. And then you will get endocytosis, bringing the membrane back into the cell. Exocytosis, remember, was the release of the transmitter. And finally, then we can look for postsynaptic events triggered by the transmitter that diffused across the synapse. Or, in fact, if there's presynaptic receptors for neurotransmitter that affect those presynaptic receptors as well. So it's a sequence of events going on. Everybody clear on that sequence? Relationship between different proteins that play a role there. Okay. Neurotransmitter out in the synapse doesn't last there very long. Typical synapse, the clearance time is much less than a half a millisecond's time. So 5 microseconds after the fusion event, you typically see the highest concentration of neurotransmitter in the synapse. It's at that point in time actually had time to cross the synapse in many cases and began to bind to and interact with postsynaptic or presynaptic receptors. By 50 microseconds after the fusion event, the neurotransmitter has largely diffused away from that site just by thermal action. Brownian motion of those molecules, diffusion. During that time as well, there's other processes going on. One we call reuptake. What does that name suggest is going on? It's being taken back up. In many cases, by the neurons themselves, but since neurons are minority cell types in the nervous system, what other type of cells do you think take up lots of transmitter? Glial cells. And we'll be talking about both mechanisms of action throughout the semester. And by a half of a millisecond, 500 microseconds, concentration of neurotransmitter tends to be very low. And this is in synapses that don't contain enzymes to further degrade that transmitter. And we will look at specific examples where there's enzymes stuck out there to still further reduce that concentration. So a really fast fusion event, a slower diffusional event, but still really fast. And again, it doesn't last for very long. And then most of the transmitter is gone again. Unless you're doing something like taking an antidepressant, which is preventing reuptake of the neurotransmitter, keeping it out there for longer periods of time. Not going to ask for a show of hands for that population. It tends to be too large a show of hands, unfortunately. Question?
Is the postsynaptic depolarization then not a single event, but as a tapering event?
It's individual channels. So if you look at single channel data, it's going to look different from whole cell data. And we'll look at some of those variations throughout the semester. And hopefully those of you who take neurophys get a lot of detail on that as well. I hope. Let's look at an example of some of those sorts of postsynaptic events. Just for the last couple things for today. The first type of postsynaptic events that anybody actually had the equipment that they were capable of measuring. These days, we would look at them and probably say this is miniature EPSPs, miniature excitatory postsynaptic potentials. But in the old days, electrode technology was not as good, amplifiers weren't as good. So as far back as, say, 70 or 80 years ago, people were still able to monitor larger cells, larger nerve fibers, at the neuromuscular junction, motor outputs from the nervous system. So there they called them not EPSPs, but EPPs, end plate potentials. EPP for end plate potentials. And they noticed that if you impaled a presynaptic motor nerve, turned your stimulator way down low, or in fact didn't even turn it on, just had it ready to go, and then also put an electrode into a postsynaptic motor fiber, you would get different amounts of activity in the postsynaptic cell. You get lots of little blips like this. And those would happen over and over again. Lots of times there'd be nothing going on. Even in fact, if you turned your stimulator on, tried to stimulate the nerve. And nothing happened, even though you were stimulating, they called them failures. No neurotransmission. The most common of the events going on tended to be these sorts of things. They had a very steady amplitude. Smallest amplitude that you always observed. So they called them singles. They noticed that occasionally you'd get one that was twice that size. We call those doubles. Every now and then you'd get a triple, or in this case, a quadruple. They were always integer increments of the singles. And once they understood the mechanism more, they related that this was the amount of depolarization in the muscle cell caused by release of one vesicle. Single meant one vesicle released. Double meant two vesicles released. Triple or quadruple, so on. These experiments only work when the system is not overtaxed, so that every vesicle is filled with about the same number of molecules of transmitter. You stimulate it too fast, you're running the system faster than it can fill up again, and the size of the singles goes down. But these sizes of single vesicles then led to the entire field that is called quantal analysis. It's called a single quantum, the smallest unit of neurotransmitter released. Not like quantum physics, where you're talking about unitary particles. Here you're talking about the quanta of transmitter in a single event, one vesicle of transmitter, and what it does to the cell that sees that transmitter. And the whole basis of modern neurophysiology is based on this quantal analysis. Did these last very long? Look at this time scale. Just a few milliseconds, the postsynaptic depolarization. And not huge amounts of depolarization. The scale bar is 2 millivolts, so a typical single is maybe a millivolt or less. Not a huge change in the membrane potential. So they were really pushing the limits of their technology at the time. When you turn the stimulator up, so that now you're actively evoking those in-play potentials. Again, the most common is one event, followed closely by 2 events. Less common to get 3, still less common to get 4 or 5 or more. Even for the massive synapses that we find at the neuromuscular junction, it's rare to get more than 5 vesicles released at a time. And most common is 1 vesicle at a time. You look at spontaneous activity when you're not really cranking the stimulation, most common is 1. How many synapses, in the synapses in your brain right now, while you're thinking about what we're talking about, how many vesicles do you think get released per synapse most of the time? Over here or over here? You're generating the activity. We're not putting a stimulator in your head. In your brain right now, most of the synapses are releasing 1 vesicle per synapse. That's been reliably shown hundreds of times now. Not the way most people conceptualize it. They conceptualize lots of transmitter all the time. Your brain, in most cases, is just barely cranking over. Like it's a car motor that's just idling along. And sometimes it doesn't even fire. It has what we call failures. And there's large numbers of those failures that occur. Hopefully, for your sake, those failures are not the predominant event when you're taking the next test. You'll have at least the average number of spontaneous single vesicle releases. And maybe under exceedingly excessive conditions, you get more than a vesicle released at a time. But in the central nervous system, that tends to be really rare. Not the way we usually think of the brain working. Keep that in mind, though. That's all I had for today. If you have any questions, feel free always to come up and ask.